Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, the Trump administration announced major rule changes to Head Start, a federally funded program that provides early childhood education to children from low-income families. Some of those changes include eliminating federal requirements for student-teacher ratios and relaxing certain safety guidelines and educational standards. In many cases, it hands authority over those standards to individual states. The public has 60 days to submit their input on the proposed changes before they can go into effect. According to a statement from Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., quote, "We are removing unnecessary bureaucracy, strengthening nutrition and physical health, trusting parents and local communities, and opening Head Start to hundreds of thousands more children." In Wisconsin, Head Start serves 16,000 children statewide. We're joined now by the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association, Jenny Maurer. Jenny, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, April Mullins-Datko, Head Start Director for ADVOCAP, a social service agency serving Fond du Lac, Winnebago, and Green Lake counties. April, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jenny, as these proposed rule changes have come out, what have you seen as a reaction from Head Start programs around the state?
So there's a tremendous amount of anxiety and fear about how these changes could really impact the safety and quality of a program that's just so powerful and critical to our communities across the state. Folks are really digging in and trying to figure out what these changes will mean, and particularly worried about the ratios and the push to pack more kids into classrooms.
April, in addition to those ratios, what stands out to you as potentially affecting your program's operations significantly and maybe most quickly from this fairly long list of changes?
Sure. So you're right. There's over 100 pages of standards that have been removed. And so that is going to, if these were approved as is, this would indicate that we would have to begin a comprehensive review of every policy, every procedure, every training plan, every monitoring system, and every operational practice to determine that what we're doing is still in line with the new performance standards. And that just takes time to revise policy, retrain employees, update systems. And so these changes, there doesn't seem to be a very clear benefit for kids and families. But there is a great amount of administration work that's going to have to go into these things, yet they want to cut administration and red tape for grantees. So it's very confusing.
Jenny, on that administrative side of things, these changes would limit the amount of money Head Start funding recipients can use for administration costs. That could cover a lot of ground, of course. The argument from the White House is, hey, we're taking away some regulations. We're making it easier, in effect, to comply with federal standards so you won't need as much time put into administration. What is your read on that element of the changes?
Yeah,
so,
Jenny, yeah, go ahead.
So I would really encourage us to pause and think about what those administrative folks are doing. Those are folks who are preparing HR paperwork and compliance. Those are folks who are setting up the bus monitor schedule. Those are folks who are running background checks and facilitating really the engine that drives an organization. We really want to make sure Head Start is all about keeping kids safe, loved, and nurtured. And that does require administrative work. I would want us to think about what administrative procedures we can give up. Head Start is a program that the budget is primarily staff capacity, and there's not much flex to give, especially in our small rural programs. They don't have additional programming that could help absorb the needed administrative costs in other program areas. And so I think this particularly puts small rural programs at risk.
Jenny, getting back to those, workforce ratios, a lot of child care centers are already facing a workforce shortage to saying, hey, you can have more kids per staff member, potentially allow Head Start centers to serve more kids.
Yeah. So, I think that at first blush, folks are saying, oh, maybe this is a good thing. But for my own kids, I want them to be in a child care environment, a Head Start environment that's quality nurturing and helps prepare kids, for school and for life. And the answer isn't just packing more kids into the classroom. I think about if we were to go to, let's say, Idaho's ratios as an example for infants and toddlers, where they allow one staff member for up to six, infants and toddlers. There's barely enough time in the day for bottle feeding, changing diapers, getting kids down for a nap, let alone those things that we know help build young child's brains, like reading, playing, getting outside, having those quality teacher-child interactions that are building our littlest minds and supporting them as they're navigating their first years of life. Children aren't robots. It's not just about producing more widgets here. It's about building our earliest Wisconsinites, and just adding more kids really puts their education at risk.
April, there's not a requirement that a particular Head Start outfit would change their ratio. It just allows them to. Would you see potentially, even if these rules come into effect, Head Start agencies in your service area sticking with their current standards, even if the regulations are loosened?
So that becomes tricky, because once the standards kind of tell us what the feds expect from us, and if they're telling us, hey, you can put 20 kids with one staff member in a classroom, we consider that high quality. They're setting the tone for grantees that they expect that is good quality. They're also setting the tone that that is what we will fund. We will only fund this. So anything that you choose to do above and beyond the performance standards will become a financial liability for the agencies.
We're talking to Jenny Maurer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association, and April Mullins Datko, Head Start Director for ADVOCAP, a social service agency serving Fond du Lac, Winnebago, and Green Lake counties, looking at the Trump administration's proposed changes released yesterday to Head Start, the program that provides early childhood education to children from low-income families with federal funding. April, I want to zoom in on your service area. You're serving a city like, say, Fond du Lac and the surrounding rural areas. Those rural areas, how important is Head Start specifically in those, and what kind of unique challenges might Head Start programs face in rural areas?
So Head Start is critical for rural America, all over the nation. Head Start is often the only early childhood programming in rural areas. And so reducing the ability to serve rural America there is going to really impact low-income families who aren't close to cities or other opportunities. And we know our rural families already face so many barriers to every other aspect of their life, medical care, education, everything. So that would greatly impact the abilities of rural Wisconsinites to have access to childcare. We're in a state childcare desert, and I know in Green Lake County, I'm one of the few. I operated one of the few centers this past program year there, and so it would be critical. It would be a loss, a huge loss to the community to lose those opportunities for high quality childcare programming across the nation.
Jenny, among the changes, loosening the requirements for these centers to serve children with disabilities or multilingual children, how big an impact do you see that having?
I think there's a lot of rhetoric as it relates to English-only education, but I encourage anyone who has questions about this to consider what it's like to be in a room full of children and trying to get their snow pants on if you don't have someone that speaks their home language. We have classrooms, for example, in Western Wisconsin, rural Wisconsin, with our ag families where there's predominantly Spanish-speaking classrooms. And if we were restricted to only talk to those kiddos in English, it hampers their ability to develop English. There's great data that talks about speaking the home language as a way to support English acquisition. But again, thinking about putting on those snow pants, if you don't have a teacher or teacher's aide who speaks the language of the children. It's not practical and it's not evidence-based. So I would really want us to push back and think about the pragmatic realities of working with infants and young toddlers, and just the challenges that poses and wanting to make things as effective as possible. So, you know, particularly when this proposal talks a lot about flexibility, but if you read between the lines or read the lines in particular, putting restrictions like English-only education doesn't sound flexible nor responsive to the children in the care of so many amazing Head Start providers.
April, do you see any positive changes in this statement from the White House yesterday?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, anytime we can look at a bureaucracy and red tape and really reduce just standards for no, that have no impact on quality or they're just paperwork, we should absolutely take the opportunity to look, review, and modernize. I don't think any Head Start grantee is opposed to that. What we're opposed to is fundamentally altering the very aspects of our program that make us what we are. And I don't like how in these new standards, it creates 50 plus different versions of Head Start by pushing all of this control back to the state. A child's experience shouldn't depend on which side of a state line they live on. The quality shouldn't be impacted that way. I didn't have to learn a different definition of Head Start when I moved to, from Kentucky to Wisconsin because Head Start has always had one national standard. And that's what's made us so strong. And it's definitely worth protecting.
Briefly, Jenny, what are you recommending to Head Start providers around the state to prepare in case these changes come into effect as currently written?
Yeah, I think the first step is to get educated on what is in this proposal and to speak up. We know that our Congress is watching, and Head Start is bipartisan and really supported by the entire Congress. And we need to let our congressional officials know that Head Start quality, Head Start standards are worth saving for rural Wisconsin to urban Wisconsin. These are standards that we need to fight back, and we need to tell our elected officials and the folks in the White House that cutting standards isn't about quality. It isn't about flexibility. It's really about cutting what has the most impact for kids and families in Wisconsin and nationally.
Jenny, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And April, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
April Mullins-Datko is Head Start Director for AdvoCAP, a social service agency serving Fond du Lac, Winnebago, and Green Lake counties. Jenny Maurer is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association. We talked to them about the Trump administration's proposed changes to Head Start, a federally funded program that provides early childhood education to kids from low-income families. There's a 60-day public comment period going on now. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, just days away from the primary election, the Inside Wisconsin Politics team digs into the home stretch for a hotly contested Democratic primary for governor. That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. There are just a few days left before the August 11th Democratic primary for governor. The moderate wing of the party seems to be finally rallying around one candidate to oppose frontrunner Francesca Hong, who campaigns as a Democratic socialist. But is it too late for Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley to gain enough traction with Wisconsin voters? In the latest installment of Inside Wisconsin Politics, our political reporters survey the field and look at some of Hong's old social media posts, which are getting some fresh scrutiny. Joining the discussion are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
So it seems like just a few weeks ago on this show, we were all kind of wondering where all these candidates in this big primary fit. What were their political lanes? It seems like the mainstream frontrunner at that point was less clear. Zach, why is it sort of coming into focus now, and is there enough time?
Well, I think you have to look at this primary in the context of the national political mood for primary voters, which are Democrats that are mainly angry at Donald Trump and his administration. They're, if you look at it in that frame, the establishment's the bad guy. The establishment is national Democrats who haven't done enough to stand up to Trump. So tapping into those voters meant you couldn't be the establishment because then you were on the side of inertia. So Francesca Hong clearly moved to the left. She was going to fight. And a lot of the other Democrats in this race were trying to outflank her, and they just could not. Even as late as a few weeks ago, David Crowley was not happy to be called the establishment. Mandela Barnes denied that there was any lane that he could be put into before he dropped out of the race. No one wanted to be pinned as establishment because that kind of denied them access to the voters that were upset and wanted change. That looked like more of the same. And so it is a little too late in the sense that if there's a lot of votes that have already been cast, but it is now clearly going that there has to be a centralized candidate of establishment power if they want to challenge the lane that Francesca Hong has already solidified for herself.
And Anya, you've covered David Crowley. I mean, it seems like he still doesn't want that establishment label for a variety of reasons. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is what Zach just described, is that there's really a lot of anger towards the establishment for, I think, what Democrats feel, or some Democrats feel, has been inertia and sort of not enough of a fight and not wanting the status quo. But also, David Crowley has a particularly kind of interesting personal backstory. He comes from a really sort of impoverished, challenged background in Milwaukee. And so up until, you know, he dropped out the first time in this race, he was kind of described as potentially not electable because statewide there's sometimes, you know, negative feelings about Milwaukee. There is, you know, always the racial element of the fact that there's never been a black man elected to statewide office in Wisconsin. So there were all these questions about him. Then he comes back with the endorsement of Tony Evers, and all of a sudden he's described as the establishment. One thing I've heard from a lot of his supporters is like, well, which one is it? Is it that he's too Milwaukee or is he too establishment? He can't be both. Why is he being held to the standard? And I think he's also trying to say, you know, I've really kind of had to fight to get everything that I've ever had. I was not handed things. I am not on this kind of gilded establishment path. That said, I do have some of this backing and the resources that will allow me to win. So again, it's a little bit threading the needle of I'm a viable candidate, but I will also stand up to the things that you're angry about.
You know, I always worry when we start putting candidates into camps like this, whether this is just sort of a media narrative that we've created or if there's something real to it. But I feel like the fundraising numbers that came out this week, Rich, do put some substance behind the idea that there are these camps emerging between Francesca Hong and David Crowley. What did they show?
Well, they showed a couple of things that were pretty notable. First of all, Crowley raised more than twice as much money during the month of July, most of the month of July. He raised $776,000 thereabout, and Hong brought in around $339,000. So that is a big sign that, at least in terms of money, Crowley's campaign is getting some backing. And the other sign that caught my attention was Governor Tony Evers, you know, who endorsed Crowley's campaign, which is definitely being framed as an alternative to Francesca Hong. He also gave $20,000 from Evers' campaign account to Crowley's campaign account. That's not a lot of money, but I was talking with Anthony Chergosky, the political science professor over at UW La Crosse, and he said, you know, it's not a lot of money. $20,000 doesn't buy you a whole lot, but it could be a signal to Evers' donors, Evers' supporters, that I'm not just saying I support this, I'm putting my money behind it. So Chergosky was saying it's potentially possible that it'll open up some more of that money from the more moderate, quote-unquote, establishment wing of the party.
Yeah, I mean, I think anecdotally, I do see the message being received as some of these other candidates' campaign signs in my neighborhood anyway, in Madison, that we're supporting people like Sarah Rodriguez, for example, have changed to David Crowley. I guess my question, though, Zach, is can Governor Tony Evers, popular governor, popular within the party, but a lame duck governor, this late in a primary campaign, kind of steer the ship like this? Can he tell everybody at once, at the last minute, hey, vote for this guy?
He can try, but the evidence throughout history shows that endorsements don't do a lot, especially late. Early endorsements show that a candidate has viability. Early endorsements from unions or from old political people can really surge momentum early in the game when it's necessary for someone like David Crowley to have boosted his name in a crowded field. Late in the game, it has less impact because people have made up their own minds and they're less likely to be swayed by one political figure. They can say, oh, that's nice, you like him, but I've already had time to make up my mind. And we've seen it with the Michigan governor and her endorsement in the Michigan Senate race and her candidate losing. We've seen it in other places where endorsements don't have the same power that maybe they did 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, when bestowing the next person as an establishment figure meant a lot more than in today's politics.
And the governor wants to frame it as sort of a binary choice, a two-candidate race. It's not that. There are still other candidates in the race, Senator Kel DeRoys, former Department of Administration Secretary Joel Brennan. Anya, how do they fit into this? And, you know, what could they play? What role could they play in this primary?
Yeah, I mean, we do end up kind of talking, and we have for the last couple of weeks, about it as almost a Crowley-Hong race. And so they do end up kind of getting some perhaps shafting in the conversation from the media, because I think there's a sense that this is Hong's race to lose, is the phrase that you've used before. And so it's kind of Hong against everyone else. And so Crowley has been sort of the anointed one, but then Roys and Brennan are just kind of in the mix there. And so I think it really is, again, when we talk about establishment versus progressive, the other three candidates just kind of get lumped together. They're obviously trying to distinguish themselves. Again, when we talk about endorsements, Kel DeRoys got this really important teachers union endorsement that didn't seem to really shift anything early on, whereas, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that would have been a much more meaningful thing. So again, I think it just kind of speaks to Francesca Hong is running a really unique, strange race. She has not raised as much money, but it doesn't seem to matter. She's making sort of headlines on her own, sort of organically, rather than through these paid ways. And then all these other candidates are just trying to catch up.
And she's not putting herself on TV, but other people are. You've had these Republican groups consistently putting her on TV ads, calling her liberal ahead of this primary.
She has spent $0 on television, which is just unheard of in any type of like serious race. And she's not running just a serious race. She's running the leading race. She's doing some, you know, digital media and things like this. But a lot of her campaign is very grassroots, very kind of door to door. And so you're right. When we see, if you see her face on your TV or on your YouTube, it is because these Republican groups are paying for ads, trying to get her over the finish line because they think she's beatable. But meanwhile, she kind of says, you know, thanks for calling attention to my policies.
So our election is not happening in a vacuum. There is kind of this wave of Democratic Socialist or Democratic Socialist-backed candidates around the country who have done exceedingly well in this year's politics compared to in previous years. This week in Michigan, Abdul El-Sayed, a progressive candidate backed by Democratic Socialist allies, narrowly won a primary there for a U.S. Senate seat over an establishment-backed congresswoman. Anya, I guess everyone is taking the exact same message from this one, right? Everyone's on the same page about what it means for here.
Yeah, you know, in politics, everyone just reads everything in the exact same
way.
We're
on the same page.
So, of course, you know, again, this overarching question this year is like, what direction are Democrats going in? Are they going in this more progressive lane or not? And so I think for people who want to see that DSA backing and these kind of more progressive leanings are viable in a way that they haven't been before, El-Sayed's victory is a signal of that. But David Crowley is saying, actually, the fact that it was so close gives me hope for my campaign, because he had all of this outside funding, he had all of this outside attention, and he still didn't run away with it. And so even though, again, we see all these polling numbers and things like this that indicate that Hong is currently running away with the primary, he's saying we actually might be really surprised on primary night.
Yeah, I mean, Rich, we haven't reported on this, and, you know, we typically don't talk about these internal polls, but this one was interesting from the Crowley campaign, where they said, hear me out. This is actually exactly what we want to hear for Wisconsin's primary, and it sort of stepped through, I guess, all of the qualifications that you'd need to get there. But big picture, what is Crowley's camp saying in terms of why Michigan could mean good things for us?
Well, for one, they're saying, this memo was saying that the primary polling that's been done in Wisconsin also just isn't the kind of polling you want to do to really know where candidates are at. They said it was top line and not looking at people who actually vote in these sorts of primaries. The other thing it was that they were saying that primary voters, you know, because of past numbers from governor races before and Senate races, et cetera, show that in a primary, it's generally the oldest the group, you know, 65 and up, that vote the most. And they're saying Crowley is the only candidate talking directly to those people right now. So as you mentioned, there were a lot of qualifiers to get to the part of the memo from the Crowley camp that said this is essentially a toss-up between the two of them. So it will be interesting, because what I've also noticed is some pollsters have said there's like this 10 to 13 point error rate kind of built into primary polling. I mean, that's what we saw in Michigan. El Sayed was leading by 19 points in one of these polls, and the race came out to be really close. He won, but not by those sorts of numbers. So what does that say for the polling that we've been relying on in Wisconsin to kind of get a sense of who is in the front and who's, you know, second place? I don't know.
Yeah, Zach, if help me walk through this. You had like basically four things you had to suppose. One was that the primary electorate is not what the polls show. It's more like 2018, 2020, that those are older voters and that they're going to go for David Crowley. And that if you really boil it down to a two-candidate race, which is not, he does even better. And when you inform them of David Crowley, that his numbers get even better and put him over the top.
Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions built into this best-case scenario that even then only puts it as a toss-up for David Crowley. But that is the odds that he's got against him in this scenario, given all that we know about the campaigns as they stand right now. And things that are different from Michigan is Michigan didn't have multiple candidates that had already secured absentee votes and then dropped out of the race. We don't know how many votes have already been cast for Sarah Rodriguez, for Mandela Barnes. But I know there are some, because I've talked to voters who said, I already voted for them. Those votes aren't coming back. They are gone. They will not impact the winner other than the margin of difference and questions of, hey, would that have made a difference if they had dropped out earlier, or if those voters had waited, or if they could have spoiled those ballots and recast them? Those are all things we won't know. A lot of this is, in hindsight, it'll all make a lot more sense. Right now, it's a lot of projection, and it's Crowley saying, hey, don't count me out. Don't just front run her away to Fran because she's in the lead right now. I have a legitimate chance. So if you believe this talk about establishment and I'm the man, then vote for me.
All right. As our election becomes the next big thing in U.S. politics, we're seeing more national attention and scrutiny of Francesca Hong. That includes scrutiny of her social media feed, old tweets, including one where she talked about Thanksgiving. In a since-deleted tweet from 2020, she said, quote, cancel Thanksgiving, should have done this in 1621. If it takes a worldwide pandemic for us to realize we should stop celebrating colonialism and the original super spreader event that killed indigenous folks and women, so be it. An open question to the group here, is this tweet relevant in 2026?
It is, in that people are talking about it. It's we're talking about it here. It's made national news, national headlines. And you know who loves to hear about this? It's the Republicans and Tom Tiffany. So I think the context that can be added to this tweet is 2020 is when Francesca Hong was first running for the assembly, running in a very liberal district in Madison in an open primary. So everything she was saying, whether she believes it now or wants to talk about it now, she was saying to a liberal primary audience in Madison in 2020, coming out of the George Floyd protests, coming out of COVID, all the situations around that. When you put it in context, her tweets look like a candidate running for that office at that time. The fact that she is a different candidate running for a different office today, we've seen this from lots of politicians who say, yeah, let's not talk about that. That was my race for state senate. That was my race for assembly. Not every politician will always love the stuff that's dug up from past votes or past campaigns, but she does have to deal with it. And so that is what her campaign is having to handle right now.
Yeah, I guess, man, I think about politics as sort of the customer is always right business, the customer being the voter. That's where even if you don't think they're right, you're in the business as a candidate of winning votes. And so if enough people want to pay attention to a tweet about Thanksgiving, you got a choice to make, Rich. Do you either kind of hope it moves on to the next news cycle or you say something about it? How has Francesca Hong been handling it?
Well, to me, it seems like she's tried both. Initially, she was saying things like, well, if Republicans want to focus on that sort of stuff, you know, we're busy reaching out to voters and building up our support, et cetera, et cetera. So she was kind of waving it off. But this week we saw Hong kind of backtrack on that tweet in particular and a whole other slew of tweets calling for from the past, calling for abolishing police, abolishing ICE, abolishing the U.S. Senate, et cetera, et cetera. So, but with regard to the Thanksgiving tweet this week, she said to CNN, she didn't really say whether or not she still supports, you know, canceling Thanksgiving. She said it's a that holiday brings a lot of pain to a lot of communities. But she stopped short of giving a definitive answer. And then on Wednesday, she was asked by Politico about that tweet, and she said, or they asked what her favorite holiday is, and she said Thanksgiving. She said, "I don't want to cancel it. I love it." So that's obviously kind of backtracking, whether that's because she saw this as a liability or she's trying to put it to rest. I don't know, but that and also she said, you know, in the televised debate not long ago and in these media interviews at the national level, she said, well, I, as governor, can't defund the police. And, you know, she essentially walked back those as well. So it's been really interesting to see, not surprising for a person in that position, but always notable.
And, you know, you alluded to the office that she's running for now. You get a different flavor of tweet from her, or I guess a post on X now than you did then. She's made recent posts about Thanksgiving, this one from last year where she talked about supporting the Goodman Center in a fund drive. A crucial note there, she is dressed up in one of those pictures as a turkey. So seems like fully embracing the Thanksgiving holiday right now. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us. This has been Inside Wisconsin Politics.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer. Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR and PBSWisconsin.org. If you have a question you'd like the reporters to discuss, email insidewisconsinpolitics@wpr.org. Please include your first and last name with your question. Coming up, an Art Glass Festival in the Fox Valley is still on despite last week's tornado. Get a preview and meet a glass furnace called Ray the Mini Dragon.
He gets up to 2,100 degrees and he holds about 15 pounds of glass. So we're able to pull that glass out with a glass blowing pipe and manipulate it into different vases, cups, bowls, you name it, we can make it.
That's next on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Reading is a major part of childhood. It transports you to new worlds and helps you explore the far reaches of your wildest imagination. What makes a good children's book? WPR's Jenny Peek went into award-winning children's book author and Wisconsin's own Kevin Henkes to find out.
I wanted to find out what makes a great children's book, something young readers keep coming back to. So I asked some kids in my neighborhood.
That it has fun pictures and that the words are big so I can read them.
I like books with cliffhangers because it makes me want to read another one.
I like when the words rhyme and are fun to read.
That was 6-year-old Artemis Galaski, 8-year-old Madeline Carter, and my 6-year-old son, Liam Howell. And they're right. They have to be fun to read. But what makes a book fun? I took that question to one of my family's favorite writers, renowned children's book author Kevin Henkes, who happens to live in Madison. He says it's all about timing.
There is a rhythm, there is a flow, there are beats, particularly with picture books, because I think the goal is that they're going to be read aloud again and again and again. So you want the words to be exactly right. The rhythm of the words is really important. And you know right away when it works and when it doesn't.
If Henke's name doesn't ring a bell, his books likely do. He's behind the beloved Mouse books Chrysanthemum, Lily's Plastic Purse, and Wemberly Worried. His picture book, Kitten's First Full Moon, won the Caldecott Medal.
It was Kitten's first full moon. When she saw it, she thought, there's a little bowl of milk in the sky, and she wanted it. So she closed her eyes and stretched her neck and opened her mouth and licked. But Kitten only ended up with a bug on her tongue. Poor Kitten. Still, there was the little bowl of milk, just waiting.
Beyond rhythm, Henke's likes to take young readers through familiar, everyday events.
I am drawn to small domestic stories. I guess I kind of grew up in the school of write what you know, and so I think my books reflect that. But I think even if you take like an ordinary character, what seems like an ordinary setting, if you really examine it with details that are telling, you find out more about life.
Some of those topics include nerves on the first day of school and jealousy when a baby brother arrives. Henke says he finds inspiration everywhere.
I think writers and artists are observers, so we're always kind of watching. I love like being at an airport and watching people. I love just in the grocery store overhearing bits of dialogue.
The first several books Henke's wrote and illustrated featured realistic humans. He switched to animals like rabbits and mice in the mid-80s and found it really let him lean into humor.
By drawing mice, I can heighten the humor in a way. So in Julius, the Baby of the World, when Lily screams into Julius's ear or pinches his tail or whatever, if I did the same thing with realistically rendered adults, it might not be funny.
But even in the world of animals, Henke's wants his stories to be realistic. He says he thinks of them as little sitcoms. That means there has to be a problem. The problem escalates and eventually gets solved. Along the way, there are plenty of laughs. And for me, that's kind of what it's all about. My two kids sitting on my lap, laughing together as we end the day with a good book. And that's what Henke hopes all of his readers get out of his books, too.
I mean, more than anything, I hope that they have a good time. I hope that they enjoy the story. I mean, that's most important. And I love it when books become part of a family's collective life.
WPR's Jenny Peek brought us that story on children's author Kevin Henke's. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. This is WPR News. Glass is the star performer at an art festival this weekend, going on despite last week's tornado. The Glass Arts Festival in Neenah started in 2022. It brings dozens of glass artists to the community, along with glass-blowing demonstrations and hands-on art projects. Most years, the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass hosts that event on the museum's grounds overlooking Lake Winnebago. Their grounds were damaged by the Fox Valley tornado, and the museum announced this week that the event tomorrow would move to the Fox City's Exhibition Center in Appleton so they wouldn't create any more work for Neenah's busy public safety personnel. Amy Moorfield is the executive director of the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass, and Taylor Moeller-Roy is studio manager at the museum. I talked to them earlier this week before that change of venue was announced. Amy, before we get to the festival, for people who haven't been to the museum, can you give us a sense of the kinds of things we're talking about when we're talking about glass art?
Sure. So the museum's been open since 1959, but we've been a glass museum since 2012. We have the largest public display of paperweights in the world, but we also have a very large contemporary glass collection, Germanic glass collection, Victorian glass collection. We're located in a historic home that's had three additions right on the banks of Lake Winnebago in Neenah, and we have eight galleries that focus on not only our collection, but other exhibitions from artists from around the globe. When you come to the museum, you'll see the beautiful glass. We also have studios and classroom, glass studio, and we've got a museum shop and beautiful lawns as well.
Taylor, I used to live around the corner from a glass studio. I saw some demos. Glass blowing is pretty cool stuff. Can you talk us through the process of creating art out of glass?
Absolutely. There's countless ways to make glass art. We're lucky enough here to be able to incorporate multiple different techniques when making glass art. I'm anything from fusing, casting. But for our glass arts festival, we always do glass blowing demo. So we work with a mini dragon, and that is the real name of it from the company that makes them. And we call him Ray, after a very, very generous donor named Raymond Smith, who unfortunately passed away. But Ray was able to help us acquire this Ray, and he gets up to 2,100 degrees, and he holds about 15 pounds of glass. So we're able to pull that glass out with a glass blowing pipe and manipulate it into different vases, cups, bowls, you name it, we can make it.
And Amy, the museum, as you said, has been around for a while. This Glass Arts Festival, just a few years old. What was your goal in creating the event?
So interestingly enough, the museum had an arts festival of all media since 1967. It was conceptualized between the museum and the JCs of NINA. Now, when I came aboard and was recruited by the museum in 2020, we were in the process of starting reaccreditation through the American Alliance of Museums. We're one of a very few group of museums in the state that are accredited. I like to say it's the stamp of approval on everything we do, from our governance, finances, taking care of our collection, et cetera. And we needed to make sure all of our programming was on mission. So I proposed to the board, this all media festival isn't on mission with us being a glass museum. And let's go ahead and try it out. It gives us distinction of being the only glass arts festival that's presented by a museum in the country. And there were some skeptics the first year, but each year we've grown our attendance tremendously. And it's an opportunity for people to experience all the different components of glass in a wonderful day that's admission free.
And Taylor, you mentioned the glass blowing demos. Take us on a little tour. What are we going to see at the festival?
Yeah, so we'll actually have glass blowing demonstrations from 11 o'clock all the way up till about 3:45. You'll be able to come in. You can actually sign up online right now to get a spot in the studio so you can be sweating in our 90-degree studio with me. Otherwise, we also have live streams throughout the museum. So if you're maybe more of someone who enjoys the air conditioning, you can still participate. And we'll start off from scratch. I'm mic'd up. I can talk through the entire process. So you guys get to learn a little bit about not only the history of the museum, glass blowing techniques, the history of glass blowing. And then by the end of it, we've made some really cool art, and hopefully everyone's learned something.
And Amy, of course, people know about the tornado that came through the area. You were not completely spared. What happened?
Unfortunately, our beautiful trees on our property were all knocked down by the tornado. We're very lucky that we were closed that day, so we weren't open to the public. But because the trees knocked out our lampposts and there was electricity that was exposed, as well as public access, we were closed for the majority of that week. Cleanup crews have worked really diligently on our behalf, knowing that we are committed to having this amazing festival this Saturday on August 8th. And we are in a space to welcome the public. And we reopened it, of course, last Friday to visitors. So sad. The view of the museum is going to look a little different. We don't have those beautiful, gorgeous trees. And some of them were planted as memorials. But onward, we're going to the show must go on.
Amy Moorfield and Taylor Muller-Roy are with us from the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass in NINA. They're hosting the Glass Arts Festival tomorrow on the museum grounds. Amy, the festival, I understand, is part of an effort to make the museum more accessible to the public. I can imagine families with children or with clumsy radio hosts might think, glass museum, I should stay away. We don't want to break stuff. How have you been trying to make it clear that, yeah, we are welcome?
It's interesting because we as part of reaccreditation, we transformed our mission to say we provide extraordinary glass experiences for all. And we've worked very hard with having programming for the very littles and the very young at heart for all age ranges. And even at the Glass Arts Festival, which is sponsored by Myron Construction, our Community First Credit Union, a kids activity tent, you could do free activities that are all referencing our collection, and they're appropriate for the littles as well as for anyone else who would like to do those free activities on the grounds.
Taylor, what kind of stuff do you do with younger people who, you know, may not be ready for that 2,000-degree glass oven, but can do some cool stuff with glass anyway?
Yeah, so we actually have programming for ages 5 and up. So we even start our kids camps as young as 5. You'd be surprised how much a 5-year-old can do with class. And we actually work all the way up to something like our Spark program, which is actually created for cultural programming for people living with memory loss and their care partners. So we try to hit, you know, all of the different points of learning that welcomes everybody. We even have different scavenger hunts downstairs where our Community First Welcome Center, where people can actually take a scavenger hunt, learn something new, and maybe investigate some parts of class that they didn't even know existed.
Amy, in addition to the glass art itself, how much is this festival an effort to build community in the Neenah area?
I mean, it's huge for us because in many ways, the museum sometimes is still considered a hidden gem. And so by offering this wonderful free experience for people, we're hoping to kind of get them to come in the door, see our beautiful galleries, our collection, and maybe they'll come back and take a class or buy something from the museum shop or tour the spaces. We have significant community programming as well. So this is our opportunity. And also, particularly with what happened with the tornado, we really want to be there and have a fun day where people can take their minds off the recovery efforts, et cetera, and just join us and enjoy the day.
Taylor, if someone checks out the glass art and maybe your glass blowing demos and thinks, gosh, I want to try that, but maybe I don't want to invest in all that gear and the dragon and things like that, what are ways people can take baby steps toward maybe learning how to blow glass?
Well, I would always suggest to people to start with our monthly art activity day. On the first Saturday of every month, we always have a $20 project. It's usually fused glass, and you can come in and kind of play and create with glass. And then maybe if you're feeling it, you can start to take further steps. Some people like to start off with our flame working classes, where you work with a small torch in front of you. So you kind of have the experience of playing with hot glass without necessarily being in the 90 to 95 degree glass. Otherwise, we also have one day one-off classes where you can come in and make your own paperweight, pumpkin, glass, and you get to work one-on-one with me. I walk you through every single step and I'm right by everyone's side as they're making their own artwork.
And Amy, as we wrap up, can you tell us a little bit about the origins of the Bergstrom Mahler?
Certainly. So the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass is steeped in some very important philanthropic folks that helped build this museum. Evangeline and John Nelson Bergstrom actually donated the land and the home. Evangeline sadly passed after her husband to the city of Neenah to create this museum. And part of their founding documents was that the museum was admission free. So from that point, Ernst and Carol Mahler, the Mahler part of the name, were some of the first board members of the museum, and they also donated the Germanic glass collection and helped Evangeline transform this beautiful historic home into a museum. And they're just some of the wonderful individuals that helped us along our way when we got our sea legs back in 1959. And to have a consistent admission-free museum, I think, is a huge gift to this community. And it defines everything we do in terms of our accessibility to the public. We also just completed major renovations at the museum. We were open and doing renovations of all of our public spaces and all of our galleries, and that just was completed at the end of June. So this is an opportunity for visitors to see, you know, the glass blowing demonstrations, the artists, over 40 on our back lawn that will be displaying their work for sale, as well as all the new spaces inside the museum itself.
Amy, have a great festival. Thanks for joining us.
Hope to see you there.
And Taylor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Amy Moorfield, Executive Director of the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass in Neenah, and Taylor Moeller-Roy, the museum's studio director. I talked with them earlier this week about tomorrow's Glass Arts Festival. Since that conversation, it was relocated to the Fox Cities Exhibition Center in Appleton in the tornado aftermath in that area. The Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass is a business sponsor of WPR. Last week on the show, we met a baton twirler from Superior who was going to compete in France as the only male member of the U.S. team. We got a text from someone who had read our online piece about that at WPR.org saying it was a fantastic article, but, quote, "I was a bit disappointed that there was no reference to Mr. Baton himself from Janesville. Don was a prominent guy in the baton world, and in Janesville, a very nice guy, too." It's referring to Don Sartell of Janesville, a.k.a. Mr. Baton, the founder of the National Baton Twirling Association, who passed away late last year. I'll admit, I want to know more about that story, so watch this space for a future conversation. Do you have a local legend who you think needs more attention here in the state? Tell us about him. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Joe Tarr, and Royce Podeswa. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Tim Peterson is our acting executive producer. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.